My name is John Frank. I'm with International Ag Labs, and I'm happy to have Dan Kittredge on the phone line. And we'll be talking about nutrient-dense foods and the significance of them, and where are they. And so I'd like to just give a real quick background. I've been working on this area with International Ag Labs for a couple of years, starting with the backyard gardens and now moving into the market gardens more. And I realize that this is the place where I really need to focus, and so I'm real passionate about it. And that's been my experience, so working from the soil side and the consulting side. And so, Dan, what's been your experience, and tell us just a little bit about yourself.
Okay. So my name is Dan Kittredge. I am an organic farmer in Massachusetts. I grew up on an organic farm. I've been doing it all my life. I have served as the executive director of a nonprofit called Remineralize the Earth, based in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is advocating and educating about the role of broad-spectrum trace elements, primarily in soil fertility. And I got involved in that work due to my analysis as an organic farmer that there were some basic mineral, broad-spectrum and general mineral deficiencies in our soils that were preventing crops from reaching maximum yields and flavor and vitality. So through my work at Remineralize the Earth, I became more and more enamored with the principles of basically the teachings of Kerry Reams and Arden Anderson and sort of the people who understand the basic biological balancing of soil fertility, looking at the soil from the perspective of the plants and biological activity. And so we have at Remineralize the Earth instituted a campaign called the Real Food Campaign, which is working to coordinate the different constituencies necessary to bring nutrient density as a food standard to the American food distribution system. So
okay,
it's a broad spectrum project, but yes, that's the basic introduction.
Wow. Can you go in just a little bit more as an organic farmer and describe some of the things, your experiences, and what you've raised, and where you've marketed, and different things like that?
So, historically, marketed as a CSA and farmers markets, health food stores. I think that's primarily it. CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, for those who don't know that. That's when consumers pay a fee at the beginning of the season and get one or two bags of produce all season long, and farmers markets and health food stores. So, I was just noticing, that crops, would not always thrive. And if, sort of coming at organic from a movement perspective as opposed to a scientific perspective, I always just assumed that organic meant that plants are better and would be healthier. But it seems that there was not a lot of sort of science and, basic biological understanding that's applied in the organic movement. So,
Right. And just as a kind of a comment in the organics, would you say that CSAs seem to be a movement of the future, or not necessarily the best way to do things?
I think direct marketing of farmers with consumers is a pretty ideal situation. I think it's not always possible, but you basically are getting rid of the middleman, so the farmer is getting pretty much the best price and the guaranteed market, and the consumers are getting absolute freshness, and they can, search around and see for their farmers that produce the highest quality. So it's the competitive edge is still there, but basically everyone's getting the best price and the best value.
Well, excellent. I know that's not direct with this discussion we have, but I felt like it's important to introduce that or talk a little bit about that, because the question that a lot of consumers are having is, where can I find good food? And to get something that they know the farmer or they know who raised it in their ethical standards is really important today.
Yeah.
And I think in light of the concerns we have for food safety, just the fact that you can find some clean food locally is a great thing for people.
Right, but you should always be aware that just because a farm is local does not mean it's clean.
That's true.
We've got a farm here in Massachusetts that's you know, marketing CSA for meat, but they're really going to the local, you know, to the slaughterhouse the next state over and buying diseased animals and selling it. So, you know, the scams will be perpetrated everywhere in all sort of marketing.
So you're saying buyer beware.
Yeah, absolutely. You need to actually meet the farmer and look at the farm and ask questions. Just because someone says they're a CSA, don't assume them to be, you know, above the pill.
Excellent. I think that what we're seeing now is a big change or shift in the way people look at food. And this call is in the context of a market garden seminar that International Ag Labs is hosting, and Dan will be speaking some on. And so we're seeing a shift, a tremendous increase in the number of people who want to grow their own produce or grow produce for sale. And I see that really growing. And even it's interesting that Walmart has a program now where they're starting to buy a little bit more local just because they don't want to pay for shipping all the way from California. So it is a movement that's really starting to grow.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Dan, can you tell me just a little bit, what's your passion now? I know you kind of touched on it, but what really drives you now?
I mean, nutrient density is nutrition, the biological potential of plants, you know, is basically untouched with our current agricultural systems. So, you know, the whole nature versus nurture conversation, the nature of the DNA of our plants that feed us is, you know, has an amazing potential, but the nurture, the soil that our plants are grown in, is, you know, extremely denuded. And so the ramifications of that on, you know, our physical health, our emotional health, our, you know, psychological health, our planetary health, just on all these different, levels, is really, really immense. So when you can understand the basic principles of how to maximize the vitality, the nutrition, the yield, the quality of crops, you know, through using, you know, through basically empowering the biological system, it just seems like a really inspiring possibility for where we're going in this country. And, you know, I think that all of the upheaval and things that are going on right now are symptomatic of the fact that we're not in a sustainable place. And so solutions like, you know, nutrient density in crops are some of the real bedrock things that our culture needs to be implementing to move forward and in a healthy fashion. So I've taken that passion and developed the Real Food Campaign, which is working with, you know, documenting who are the farmers who are currently producing nutrient-dense crops, who are the consultants that understand the principles of how to produce nutrient-dense crops, who are the, you know, where can you buy the minerals, the amendments, if you are a farmer and you want to produce nutrient-dense crops. And then, you know, once we get that, all those basic infrastructures, you know, we can document who's out there doing it, then we start to, you know, educate the consumers and get, you know, PR out to all the sort of allied consumer groups, or, you know, organic farming groups, sustainable farming groups, who are unaware of these principles, and start to raise awareness. And almost unequivocally, when people become aware of the concept, they intuitively resonate with it and want to buy the crops. And so there's the problem, is because there are people doing it around the country right now, but not many. And what is the standard? And, you know, what are the principles of how to do it? So basically all this information is known and exists in various corners, but it's not available in a broad, open, collected fashion. So that's okay. My passion right now. How's that for an answer?
That's a great answer. I share that same passion of seeing the soil restored. I like to look at soil in terms of, I like to consider the word stewarding the soil, that we're on behalf of the Creator, we're stewarding the soil to produce nutrition. And what we see in our healthcare system has been very poor stewardship to date. We're really suffering from poor stewardship. And so my passion is very similar, and it really starts, to me, in the soil. We've got to get back to the soil and meet the requirements of nature.
Right.
And then it just works its way right up, even to the health of a larger region of things beyond people's health.
And we need to understand the principles behind how do you facilitate soil health. And
that's
where the big block is, because very few people understand it from that biological perspective.
That is true, and there's lots of voices out there talking about many different things. Minerals are important, and this is important, and that's important. But we find, at least from my perspective, I find, like you say, it's very hard for a lot of people to incorporate those into a system that actually works, that they can actually bring to it and take it to the refractometer and say, wow, this is nutrient dense.
Right, exactly.
Well, good. You said you were with the Real Food Campaign. You're the director. Are you still the executive director with the with Remineralize the Earth?
No, I've stepped down from that position. I'm still on the board of directors.
I see.
But I'm wanting to focus as much of my energy as possible on the Real Food Campaign.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Well, great. I think that's good. And so you're currently are farming right now, then?
Yes.
So you're kind of busy then.
I'm a busy man, yes. I have two young children
great.
As well.
You have how many children?
Two young children.
Two young children, okay.
Yes.
Well, that's great. We've got four, and the ages on our children range from 5 to 12 and almost 13. So, and what are the ages on yours?
3 months and 20 months.
3 months and 20 months, wow.
Yeah.
Well, that always brings the really good added incentive why we want to have good food for our children and family.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So you're basically focusing your efforts now then on the campaign for real food.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, we're having a little bit of a hard time, getting paid to do it. So that's part of why I'm farming on. I'm trying to make it farming on the side, but I'm farming to pay my bills. So. This doesn't need to be covered on the conference call necessarily, but yes, that's the focus of all my energy.
Okay, so just so I am clear on this, are you encouraging consumers then to join up with the Real Food Campaign, or are you mostly trying to coordinate, buyers and sellers and producers?
At this point, we're just working to serve as an informational hub, trying to bring together the disparate pieces of information that show the picture of how to do this. So there's books out there, there's workshops, there's specialists, there's tapes, there's all sorts of scientific data documenting the validation of all this process. There's all these disparate pieces of information, and so for someone who hears about the concept and wants to get involved, whether they're a farmer or a consumer, the purpose of the Real Food Campaign initially, at least, is to be an informational hub so people can find the basic information they need to move forward. From that point, we have a strategy of being more overt as far as a consumer action campaign to document quality of produce that's currently available in the markets, and then use that information to pressure producers and retailers to begin, pressuring their farmers to grow more nutrient dense crops. But
okay, that brings me to a question: is the message of nutrient density? Actually, two questions. I would like you to define what do you mean by nutrient dense foods? But before you do that, do you believe that the organic world will take hold of the concept of nutrient density or not? I'm just curious what's your perspective on that.
I think the organic world is quite a disparate community. I think the people, you know, the sort of the wing of the organic world that I come from are the sort of homesteading, back to the land, small market gardening wing of people who are actually doing it for the soil health and for their physical health and community health. And I think for those people, they're very natural allies. For the big business, the people that have gotten into it and sort of taken the control to a large degree, not entirely, but to a large degree, I think it may be a threat because, organic is, at its essence, is a process standard, and it's not a quality standard. And what we're talking about with nutrient density is a quality standard. And so, I think that there probably will be some resistance, but as consumers become aware of the possibility of quality as a standard and begin to taste the flavor and have the experience of nutrient-dense crops, I think it's a moot point. What's really going to happen is that the consumer pressure is going to be increased, and it's in the interest of anyone who's producing crops, not just for consumer purposes, but because their yields will be increased, because their quality, their shelf life increases, because their insect and disease problems diminish. It's an economically wise decision for the producer, be it large or small. That's the whole. What's so exciting about the campaign is that it's in the interest of very, very many constituencies. It's in the interest of consumers because they can actually be eating food that will make them healthy. It's in the interest of farmers because they can be producing more and better crops with a smaller cost. It's in the interest of retailers because they can say we have the best quality produce, and consumers will go to their stores. So.
So you think market pressure is going to force individual farmers to move in that direction, whether the organic industry does or not?
Will force eventually. Farmers to? I think market pressure is how the world works, and our vote is our dollar. We vote every day with our dollar, and when people understand what's good that this is out there. I think there'll be a large upswell of desire. I think the biggest problem right now is that the quantity of food that is nutrient dense in the food supply is quite limited because this is still a relatively new concept. So that goes to your second question, which is phrased first, which is what is nutrient density? And that's, part of what we would like to do through the campaign, not so overtly, but sort of collaboratively, is bring together the specialists, the people who have been doing this for 20 and 30 years, and work to develop a standard. There's Arden Anderson, who's one of the sort of leading thinkers and specialists, has developed a standard he calls Beyond Organics, which is it's 125% of the mineral assay, a USDA average in 1940. For people who have studied the literature, the USDA has been documenting mineral assays of crops for the last 60, 70 years, and they've been going down ever since they started documenting them. So what Arden Anderson's proposing is first you have hybrids by the Carey-Reams chart. That if your crop doesn't have hybrids, then you don't consider it. So there's basically either high or excellent. It's some question of where the standard is. And then you do a mineral assay to determine if you are at that 125% of 1940 levels. And then what Arden Anderson's group in California is doing is they're doing a ORAC, which is antioxidant levels as well, and very high antioxidant levels. There's different people who are advocating different standards, but the generally, the people who are on this wavelength agree with the BRICS as the basic standard. And then it can move on from there depending on money and certification, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's a very nice recap, and I think just to look at it in the most basic terms, it is the way I would describe it as well is to say if you eat this food, you're getting more minerals and more vitamins, more enzymes, more phytonutrients in a per given amount than if you eat that food. And those are in a natural chelated food form that the body can assimilate that's far better than anything that you can get out of a bottle. And so that's what we're after. And the impact on human health is considerable.
Mm-hmm. And we need to do the studies on human health. There have been studies done in animals, but they haven't, in sort of crop, not crop animals, but farm animals. But the studies have not been done in humans that I'm aware of. Some basic things, on specific diseases, diabetes and things like that, showing nutrient-dense crops do not raise sugar levels of diabetics and things like that. But we do need to have a lot more. I mean, we need to document the quality. We need to document the phytonutrient increase. We need to document the ORAC, the antioxidant increase. We need to document the minerals. And it's not just calcium and magnesium and boron, it's 40, 50, 60 different trace elements that aren't even present in most food. That's what we're talking about, is all those trace elements that really facilitate the DNA's full replication and the full biological health, that are used in your brain and these minerals are critical for our health, and they're just not present in most food these days. So.
Well, that is important, and I agree with you that I don't have access to the studies from human health that, okay, here's the food that is nutrient-dense by the standards that we know with the nutrient levels that we know is good. Now, here's the results specifically on human health, what we've seen. That, as far as I know, just hasn't been done. Maybe, perhaps, going way back, Dr. Northern did some of that work, but I don't see any research coming out of that. But there was some hint that maybe it was done. But I know
Arden Anderson's got a PhD student who's working on diabetes and hybrid crops and how they affect diabetics. It's very disparate. So I mean, this is part of what we need to do. The organic movement was sort of haphazard and small groups of people around the country came together and said, we're all on the same page, and what is that page? And there was not really, initially there was just a smattering of groups around the country, around the world, who were trying to come up with what is organic. And so, part of the objective of the Real Food Campaign is to bring together the specialists around the country, if not around the world, early on in this movement to really, set the stage and bring together and do the research and really coordinate the process, because it's so valuable, and A, it can be facilitated so much more, and B, we really want to maintain the quality standard. We don't want people to get in and say, oh, nutrient dense, and just have it be another empty marketing phrase. We want it to mean something, and we want to be able to show what it means and how it affects people. So yeah, this is all work that needs to be done, and as usual, money is a limiting factor. So that's what we're struggling with right now, and that'll be, But the idea is, the more that we get these basic principles clearly explained and out there, the more people will understand the real value of this and the potential of this. So we'll see how that evolves.
Okay. I'm speaking on behalf of a housewife. All right, she wants to cook for her family good food.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What does she do today?
Right. So this is part of what we're working with on the Real Food Campaign. We're actually, just about a couple weeks away from putting up a database online. What you do today is you get a refractometer, which we will be selling as part of our membership through the Real Food Campaign, or you can just go on eBay or wherever to buy one. A refractometer is basically it's a prism. So what you do is you You take your food, whatever it is, if you're, you know, beans or carrots, and you need a garlic press or some sort of press, and you press out a couple of drops of liquid from that food, and you look at it through the prism, which is called the refractometer, and you see where that, you know, comes through, and you see how much the light refracts. There's a little chart on the refractometer, and that gives you a number, and you correlate that number with the Carrie Reams Rix chart, and you see where it stands. So you can basically look, you can organize your purchasing habits if you're buying your crops from to find where you get the highest Rix carrots or beans or squash or tomatoes or whatever it is you're buying. So that's what you can do in real time. You need a refractometer and a garlic press. And if you wait a couple of weeks, you can get it through our website, realfoodcampaign.org. The other thing that we're trying to do through the campaign is have up online a list of the farmers around the country who are currently doing this. So if you want to buy, you know, carrots for the winter or apples or potatoes or grains or things like that, we have a list of people across the country who have bulk supplies of these, who are growing them in a nutrient-dense fashion. So, yeah.
Okay, well, that brings to a point here. I've got an email from David Pelley, and he is a consultant in Canada, and he mentions that he's checked mangoes that were imported out of Pakistan, and they were Rixing 26.
Oh,
and then he checked Mexican mangoes, and they were Rixing 14. Basically, he says the Rix chart says 14 is high for mangoes, and that's really an indicator that we probably got to look carefully and work also, in addition to other research that we're doing, is to revise that chart on occasion when we see that it needs revision.
Yeah,
I've tasted some of those Mexican mangoes that are not too hot, and I can tell you they're not very appealing.
The 14.
Yes.
Right. Well, yeah. They probably. I think we're fairly clear on the sort of the major food crops that are grown in you know the 48 contiguous states. So this is where this sort of research was initially done. I think a lot of these other crops have sort of been put on there, and you know have not the due diligence has not yet been done. So you know I'm not sure if there's guavas on there or not, but I think those kinds of things are, if you look at broccoli or tomatoes or grapes or corn, those numbers are pretty good, pretty solid.
So you would say then for the housewife, then let's just say that they go to several different stores that they go to, including maybe an organic store. Just go ahead and get a small quantity of a single vegetable from all these different locations, and come home, and then just do a comparison on the Rix reading. And,
or 1 week, you know, go to one store. If you've got, I don't know, if you say you've got three grocery stores in your region that, you know, are close proximity. If you don't have that, then you don't really have so many choices. But say you've got three grocery stores, 1 week, do your shopping at one store and you know, document the Rix, and the next week do it at a different store, or the next week do it at a different store. And if you can see that, you know, I mean, generally these kinds of big stores have their supply chains lined up for over an extended period of time, so the numbers aren't going to change too frequently. But, yeah, I mean, and that's the other piece of what we're doing for the Real Food Campaign is that when you get a membership, you can upload your information. So you can say, I live in, you know, Sioux City, and I shopped at, I don't know what kind of, what the name of the stores are out there, but Safeway or something, and I got the carrots that are branded under the bag Bunny Love carrots or whatever, and they were Rixing at 10. And you can upload that information on our database, and then other consumers can go online and see what you have already done. And so we can have a collective consciousness of where is the best produce and, you know, what quality is out there right now. That's one of the major pieces necessary for building this consumer action campaign. And, you know, if we don't, until we get the critical mass, it won't have a lot of value for consumers. It'll just be a value in really understanding what is the quality that's out there on the food supply right now. But if we can reach a critical mass, it'll be a very valuable tool for that housewife. She can just go online and see where the best stuff is this week.
Yeah, I think so. And
you can do it for farmers too. If you're looking at a CSA, you know, if you've got five CSAs in your region and you don't know which one to go to, if we had the consumers documenting the bricks of the crops that are bought at their CSAs, there is a real good, you know, quality management scheme, and market pressure for the best CSAs to charge a premium price and, you know, always be sold out, because there's good documentation of the fact that their produce is the best.
Okay, that brings us to another question here. What is a fair way for people who are producing nutrient-dense foods to price their foods, in your opinion?
Oh.
I can answer that. I'll answer it myself if you want, but I wanted to hear what you say.
I think the number I've heard thrown around is 125% of organic. What's your answer?
Well, my answer was to do a basic mineral density analysis, mm-hmm. and look and really try to come up with what's the dry matter, and then compare that to the dry matter that you get from, go to the grocery store and just buy run-of-the-mill low-grade produce, mm-hmm. and then buy some organic, just run-of-the-mill
organic.
Like,
say you're doing beans or something, right?
Yep, and doing green beans, let's say, and do the dry matter on what you're producing, which, assuming that's nutrient-dense, what's mm-hmm. the organic at nutrient-dense that's not nutrient-dense probably, and then what's just the conventional. And,
right.
You know, for example, I found that the green beans I grew had 16% dry matter,
mm-hmm.
and the green beans that I bought from the grocery store, just conventional, had 8%. Now, I never did carry this through and do this with the organics, but this could be done. And
right.
What I did is I took the dollar value, and then I came up with what's the price based on the retail per percent of dry matter.
Right.
So, and then. And I did that for organics, and I did that for, I'm suggesting doing it for organics and then doing it for conventional. So your price per percent of organic matter,
mm-hmm.
and then you take that, and then you take and you average the value of those two together, and
right.
then you take that times your 16% or your percentage, and you'll be quite a bit higher in value, you know, in
right.
you know, price per unit than probably either, but you're also you're given more value than either of them.
Well,
and
if you look at it from a scientific perspective, you know, the consumer is getting a lot more nutrition, and, you know, even for the dollar value, but the consumer is not looking at it, you know, with such a dispassionate perspective. They're saying, you know, these beans over here are $1.50 a pound, these beans are $2 a pound, and your beans are $4 a pound. And I love your beans, but I can't afford $4 a pound. So, I mean, I think it's an area that needs to be further you know, delved into. But my argument is, if I'm able to produce, like I was this year, I was marketing organic heirloom tomatoes at Whole Foods, and I, you know, had a 2,500 square foot greenhouse, just a hoop house. And my argument was, if I can extend the season earlier because my plants are growing faster, if I can extend the season later because I have a higher bricks and I've got more disease resistance and I've got more frost resistance, and I'm getting more production per square foot from my tomatoes because their biological system is maximized, I can charge, you know, I can be at or slightly above the organic premium and still be getting, you know, a lot more dollar per hour per square foot, however you want to manage it. and not be so far above the market price. Because if I just working with some people like Whole Foods, if you charge too much above what they're paying somewhere else, they won't buy from you. They don't care. So it's a touchy subject. And
right.
My experience is I'm getting more yield for less work. So there's no real need on my end to charge a hell of a lot more.
Okay. Dr. Reams said the cheapest production comes when you have the highest quality. It'll be the cheapest per unit, and you'll get the most yield as well. So that's something that a lot of people may not realize, is how much the yield increases.
I would focus on that point. I mean, more on that point, that you can still charge whatever you're charging for your cucumbers, $1.50 a pound, but you only need to plant those cucumbers once, because they don't die. They don't turn brown and die off, and you need to have two or three plantings. They just keep going and going and going, and they're producing more. That's the brilliance behind having the nurture, the biological system in place for the plant to maximize its potential. We farmers don't even have a very little idea what the potential is of their crops in general.
I would agree.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting. I just want to highlight just a little bit that you're going to be speaking on Prepare Now for the coming market standard, which is nutrient density. And what are some of the things that you're going to be looking at when you present this?
Well, I think I'll be touching on a lot of the themes we've covered this evening. The basic concept is that this is coming. This awareness, this quality standard is coming, and it takes a little while for a farm to turn around. You can't just put down your new fertility regimen in the springtime and all of a sudden everything's hunky dory. You really are resetting the whole biological system. It's the biological system that facilitates nutrient density, and it takes a lot of understanding and a lot of finesse to do it. What do you say, 3 to 5 years to really get there? You'll see improvements in your first couple of years, but depending on how rigorous the standard is, and depending on how sophisticated your management techniques are in the first couple of years, it's going to take a while. And so for farmers to get in on it now, it's in their interest because they're going to be increasing their quality and increasing their yields. It's really in their interest because the demand is going to be increasing in the near future. So they can really be out front and demanding those premiums when the consumer demand increases. Right now there's not much consumer demand, but it's increasing as the awareness increases.
Okay, and do you feel like these farmers need to, how much marketing are farmers going to need to be doing as they're getting the better quality?
How much marketing? There's nothing like the flavor, right? I mean, it depends on your marketing, your strategy. If you're marketing wholesale, to some trucker that's selling it in the city somewhere hundreds of miles away, you're going to have a little different logistical issues than if you've got it, and then you're selling at a farmer's market. If you're selling at a farmer's market, once people taste your watermelon or taste your beans or taste your corn, they're going to come back next time because they said, wow, that stand over there had the best whatever that crop is that I've ever tasted. So, and the same thing with CSAs and that kind of marketing. To some extent, probably local health food stores. I think that's part of what we're going to be offering at the Real Food Campaign is literature that you can download and print out explaining the principles behind all of this. Because, there is a good amount of scientific understanding involved, and so we're going to try to bring it down to a easily understandable, metaphors and clearly explained, principles. Depending on how good you are at that, more and less. But the real, but really, what's going to happen is your consumers are going to start noticing a difference, and you're going to be noticing a difference as well as a farmer.
Right, and the nice thing about it is that, you know, everybody has their own built-in refractometer, and that's their sense of taste.
Right.
And so it is going to confirming, yep, the refractometer is absolutely correct. It's
yeah.
so much better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things I'd like to point out is that the upcoming class is something that we've never done before, and we're focusing on this because we've had just such an increase in the number of people who are involved in small-scale fruit production, whether they're going into local auctions or they're going into farmers markets or even CSAs or just local, they're going right direct to local supermarkets, not even organic. And it's increasing quite a bit. And what we're trying to offer with this is the tools necessary to put all this these concepts together and come out with an overall plan, a system that can take you from point A, which is where you're at, to point B, which is the production of nutrient-dense foods. And I would just like to point out, it is the easiest thing in the world for Dan and I to get on here on the phone and just talk about how good nutrient-dense food are.
Yeah.
It's an entirely different matter when you're out on the farm and you got to come up with high-brix tomatoes. It's
right.
not a walk in the park. And so you have to really understand where you want to go, where the market's going, and how you can get in on that. And then it's going to take some time because it is a biological process to get the soil correct. And that doesn't mean if you just add compost, you got your biology out, you're fine. It doesn't work quite like that. And you've got to put these tools in place, work and get the right mineral level, the available minerals out there in the right ratios before you can see a significant increase in BRIX. And so this conference then is laying out, here are the fundamental tools that you've got to really understand and incorporate one with the other. And so you just can't understand one thing. You've got to learn how to put these tools together. And so these tools are really start with the soil test to really give you the roadmap. And we go on from there to give a broadcast of nutrients based on the soil test. And from there, we move into some of the finer tools that are still very important, the fertigation, the foliar sprays, and the conductivity in the soil. And we've really had a tremendous increase in the amount of interest that we and the attention that we pay to conductivity in the soil, and we're going to highlight some of that. It's really saved and changed a lot for farmers when they pay attention to the soil energy.
Right.
So that's why we're having this class, is to integrate those five tools and get people really thinking about where the market's going and how they want to position themselves in the future market.
Well, I think my small piece of the workshop is focusing on that market direction, but understanding that market is going where it's going. I can speak as a farmer to the level of complexity and overwhelmingness that you get into when you get into this. There's a certain intuitive resonance with the basic concepts of biological systems and maximizing the potential of the biological system and balancing it, that makes sense. And then the principles and the tools of the pH meter and the conductivity meter and the refractometer and building foliar sprays and balancing your whatever your fertigation is on top of, you know, and just the process of testing the soil and the plant sap and all of that kind of stuff, it takes a level of management and understanding that it takes I'm looking forward to going to this workshop to learn myself. I, you know, having been doing this for a couple of years now, I feel like I'm finally ready to integrate all of this kind of stuff. I've just sort of been picking it up piecemeal. So yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to going to this course because I think it's going to be really good to sort of have each one of these things thoughtfully laid out and focused on and explained in a real, you know, here's the bare bones, what it's doing, why it's important, and how you balance it and how you work it with everything else. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. We've got a local farmer, and I'll be highlighting him a little bit more, and he's basically been on our program now for 2 years, and he is very, very happy. He just could not wipe that smile off of his face this year. He's not significantly raised his prices, but and truthfully, if you take a refractometer to his produce, it's not meeting the standard of excellence. It's pushing on good, but it's probably not always in good.
Yeah,
and most
exactly.
of it's probably upper average right now.
Right, exactly.
And, for example, he had some sweet potatoes, 9.6. Well, 10 is the beginning of good.
Right.
And it's not the best that's out there yet, but he started with a soil that was, you know, really did need some work. And he's been diligent to apply the broadcast, and this is his second year, in 2.5 years he's been with us,
mm-hmm.
and he's really seeing some differences, and basically this year was a stellar year for him. He says, he told me that in all his 23 years of raising produce, he's never had a year like this ever, and really, in almost anything, he says it's double than the best I've ever had before for this crop,
and that's what's really exciting. Is I mean, it's humbling at the beginning. If you take a refractometer to your produce and you see where you're at on the chart, you know, if you're too proud, you're going to turn around and say go somewhere else because the quality that we are accepting and accept as normal and good is really mediocre. And you see this amazing, you know, enhanced growth and vitality and disease resistance and yield, and you're still, you know, only in the average category. And you think about, if this is average, you know, I can't even imagine what excellence is going to be. So
that's
what's really the exciting part is, you know, you get the minerals on, you get the biology going, and the plants have this sheen and this growth and the just... Yeah, I mean, it's quite exciting. It's quite exciting. Absolutely.
It's my observation that when you're starting to get your soil back, the first thing that comes back that you really, really notice is the outstanding level of yield.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing change from what it has been.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. You will notice better quality. It's incremental better quality, but you can all of a sudden see a dramatic rise in yield.
No, it's true. Yield doesn't increase before quality increases. Yeah.
Right. And once the yield's up, then you basically kind of have to, I wouldn't say fight, but you almost got to earn the stripes to raise it.
I think finesse is the word I use.
What's that?
I think finesse is the word I use.
Okay.
Getting to a basic good level is one thing, but then you really have to be, you know, on top of it. And I think that's part of the problem with nutrient density as it's evolved is farmers get to a level of, you know, significantly better than where they were, but far below the potential for nutrition. But because there hasn't been a consumer demand out there for that maximum nutrition, farmers have been happy to say, well, look at this, I'm getting much better yields. My cost per production is down. I'm getting better profits, and they don't really have a need to push on to the next level. So
long term, I would like to see therapeutic grade food, and that would be something that's beyond
right.
what we would consider excellent into the therapeutic grade. And I think, you know, if we can get a good variety of that type of food someplace and run that into like a retreat setting for people who are sick, I think
right.
we can do a world of good in a short time with just food.
Right. And that's when you can talk about getting premium prices.
Yeah, when we can take it to the therapeutic grade. Then, one of the things I learned in marketing, if you bring an average produce to the market will reward you with a poor price.
Mm-hmm.
If you bring to the market good produce, the market will reward you with an average price.
Mm-hmm.
And if you bring, excellent produce, it'll reward you with a good price.
Right.
But when you bring outstanding or the very
premium.
Top of the line, the most premium, the market will reward you with the most outrageous premium pricing.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And, you think about somebody who's, an Olympic person, and the difference in time between a gold and a silver is, could be fractions of a second on something.
Right.
And that's where, in the future, I think there'll be pretty strong competition to see who can get there because the value of that is so high.
Right.
We've got an email that came in from somebody who lives in Singapore, and he says that there's Japanese fruit is imported into Singapore, and it is noted for its taste. They don't really understand nutrient density in terms of the refractometer, but they follow taste, which
right.
is about the same thing.
Which correlates directly, yeah.
And would you like to guess the difference in price between the standard average produce costs in Singapore versus the Japanese imports?
I don't know. 50% higher?
How much?
50% higher?
50%. No, it's four times the cost.
No, really?
No joke. And not only that, it sells out. It doesn't stick around. It sells.
People, and that's the thing. When people understand the value of it, and they will, they'll pay any price. But then the question is, a lot of farmers, at least around here, are sort of, I'm growing, high quality organic produce to sell to Whole Foods so the rich people can buy it, but I want the poor people in the cities to be able to buy it too, but I can't afford to sell it to them. So, I mean, that's when you get to some of those ethical conversations about do you just want to be charging the premium price or do you want to be feeding, people who really need it and don't have access to good food and all that kind of thing. But
And there's a point on both sides of that conversation.
Absolutely.
There really is. And so I want to just thank Mr. Lim Peng for bringing that information to me from Singapore because I think it opens our eyes a little bit.
Well, and the Japanese, Arden says that the Japanese will only import the premium quality kiwis from New Zealand based on a BRICS test. And those kiwis that fail to meet the Japanese standard are the ones that are sent to this country for consumption.
I think I had some of those today. They're beautiful green color, but they sure weren't up to standard.
And the California citrus that meets the highest BRICS standard is sent to Japan, and the rest is sent across the country. This country.
I believe that
standard is out there. It's just that the American populace is unaware, as they are on numerous subjects. So the demand isn't there. But yeah.
Well, I know,
as this all builds, there's a real opportunity for farmers that are getting in on the ground level to be years ahead of their competition.
Right, but I know a farmer, a market gardener, who's a pretty large operation, and they are doing basically everything they can to quickly come on board with the concept of nutrient-dense foods because that's what they've been talking about for a long time. But in reality, it's been hard for them to achieve it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're starting to get customers saying to them, okay, we want, this vegetable at such and such or better BRICS, and we
right.
want this and that. And they're saying, hey, we're doing the best we can. We're not there yet. We can't market it yet at a specified BRICS.
Right.
And so that's that creates a little dilemma for the producers, but it sure indicates that demand is starting to come around.
Right. And there's almost no, there's so little awareness about all of this, really, and the demand is already there and building. So, yeah. No, it's been a thing.
Yeah, well, I'm glad. So you're working to get some funding and then consolidate information and get people talking to people. And so you're going to have a website on this specifically for the Real Food Campaign?
We have a website currently up. It's realfoodcampaign.org. We're basically building it out page by page, and some of the pages are blank. Working on consolidating the information. But, I mean, working out the basic principles and the mission of the campaign are up there, but who are all of the farmers around the country and who are the consumers, the consultants, all that kind of stuff, we're still compiling. You know, all the scientific data documenting, increased yields and increased mineral density and all that kind of material is still coming. We're working on it step by step. And it's a volunteer venture right now. It's a little bit scary because we're getting all this excitement and, people wanting this and people wanting that and not having enough time and money to put it all together. So at some point, it's coming together. It's just taking its time.
Having a place then for people who want to sign up as producers to join the campaign then support the whole movement with some membership fee?
We have a general membership fee of $40, and if you want to buy a refractometer and a garlic press, it's $100. The question is, do we want farmers to say, okay, I'm growing nutrient dense crops? So, I mean, I want some standards to be present. So a farmer's word is not good enough. Either you need to have, you need to have a good soil test that passes, or you need to be working with somebody who can vouch for you, or you need to have a mineral assay on some crops that qualify. I don't want people to just sign up and say, hey, I've got nutrient dense crops, and then consumers will go and go to their farm and say this is nutrient density when it's not. It's just somebody who's falsely claiming. So it's that whole sort of validation process and standards process is something that's being worked on, and that's part of what we're struggling with right now. And documenting who are the farmers around the country is we have to sort of do our diligence on seeing the references, whether it's the consultant they're working with or their soil tests or they've got mineral assays on their crops, etc. We want to be sure that the people we're putting up on the website really are producing the high-quality crops.
Okay. Well, the difficulty in that is that the farmer might be doing everything that he can right, and yet he's still in that early phase where he's not got, documented high bricks on his produce to prove that he's doing the right things.
Well, and so that's basically what it's coming to, is there's two tiers. There's a very small upper tier of people who are really doing quite a good job, and then there's a much larger second tier of people who are in the process and, arguably do have much better quality than anyone around, but still are not up to that, excellent level. And so that's just as this all sort of the collaboration, the coordination process, moves on, that we start to see where are the natural barriers and where are the natural, standards. And it seems to be there are the people who are in the process, and I think that should be, some sort of standard. You can say we are in process, and we can see we can document the improvement in quality year over year in both crops and, soil or whatever, and then the people who have really reached that level. So I think that's probably going to be where we're at, how we'll structure the farmers listed on the website.
One other thing that, comes to my mind when you talk about this is that, first of all, I think what you're doing is really important because you're trying to create, ultimately you're creating consumer demand and you're trying to fill that with the needed production.
Right.
And so... If we can all work together on this, I mean, I want to stand behind what you're doing and just say that my encouragement for farmers and for producers is get on board with the campaign for real food, because it's going to do us all good. But, you know, in a rising tide, all the boats get raised up.
Exactly.
It's not just one boat.
Right.
And if we can work together, and so even though the details are not all worked out, I would encourage, you know, farmers, producers that are looking to sell to join this. And the other thing I was thinking, Dan, is that, you know, software is being developed as open sourcing a lot, mm-hmm. and some of the best software is open source.
Right.
And in one way that we can use for validation is just let people who buy the produce go ahead and say, okay, this farmer sold beets that were, you know, 8 bricks, and that measures whatever, however it is. And let the consumer start reporting back, and they themselves can start to paint a real good picture where that farmer's at.
Right. No, that we are actually on that. I mean, that's part of what we're doing, and doing it, you know, there's basically direct farmers and you know, and stores. So that's where how consumers right now can find where to go in their local area. But no, that's my ideal. The vision is that there will be a sort of a closed loop system where people are, where all this information is bouncing back and forth, and so it becomes naturally very clear. If a farmer says, "I'm producing nutrient dense crops," they've got. They can show their soil tests over 3 years. They can show maybe some mineral assays, and there will be consumers also validating. So that natural you know organism of community of just basic information will make it very obvious who is doing the best job in your area. That's definitely the ideal. It's just a question of, you know, time and money as usual. So.
Okay, and so go ahead and repeat one more time the website.
Yeah, it's realfoodcampaign.org.
Okay.
www, and, of course.
Well, yeah. Great. I wanted to just cover, we had a couple of comments on the blog that were directed toward you.
Okay.
And first one was a question about a daughter of India. How dense are Indian fruits and vegetables? How do you compare them to the produce in America? Many thanks.
Does this person know that I've been to India?
Your stuff, actually, on the email that I sent out, I don't know that you saw that, but...
I did say that I'd worked in India, yes.
Yeah, and that you lived in India, and that
right.
I had too, and so, yeah, I mentioned that, so...
Right. How does India correlate with the U.S.?
How dense are the Indian fruits and vegetables, and how do you compare them to the produce in America?
Right. Well, I actually was not using a refractometer when I was in India, but the Indian soils are extremely denuded. Some of the basic understanding that comes from the remineralized the earth perspective is that the broad spectrum minerals are laid down in the geological process through some basic functions, either volcanism or glaciation or siltation. That's how soils are renewed over time. And so if you look at the sort of the tropics, the Amazon is replenished through these massive, windstorms that take up minerals from the Sahara Desert in Africa and blow them over to the Amazon. There's some basic biological systems that bring minerals back to the soil. And Indian soils, you know, they had quite a good agricultural system for thousands of years, but when the Green Revolution came in the 60s and 70s, they really burned through their topsoil quite quickly. So, I think India is one of the places where they use the most pesticides. And the Indians are the most toxic, have most toxic streams of any country in the world from pesticides, from hardcore, heavy-duty pesticides. And if you understand the biological systems, you understand that those pesticides are only necessary when your soil does not have the minerals in it that the crops need to thrive and to resist infestation and disease. So. I'm not sure if that's a clear answer, but
right.
I think not so high.
Okay.
So high.
I do think the freshness is a benefit, but that is not necessarily enough. It's not enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, freshness is always much better. But I don't think the Brix levels are particularly high.
It's interesting, and I don't know what's number one, but I read recently that India is the number two producer of fruits and vegetables by country in the world. So that's
really?
Like, wow, it's huge. It's really huge.
Yeah. No, I sometimes fantasize about going back to India, and you know, there's these places in the world. There's, you know, Africa, there's Central Asia, there's these major land masses where this understanding of how to balance the minerals and you know, empower the biology could bring back deserts, could bring back total barren lands, you know, to vibrant crop production. You know, the potential through this understanding to really change the world in meaningful fashions is really immense. So
that's,
we'll see
I
how
share
it all
that
plays out.
I share that long-term vision, and
yeah,
that's
exactly.
Something that I feel like I'm here for a time, but in the long term, that may be something to work on in the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the thing that, you know, has to play into that is the impact of health in the soil will impact the vegetation, but ultimately that vegetation, it has got to impact weather patterns, or you can't really get enough inertia to do what you need to do. You've got mm-hmm. to get some rain in some of these areas.
Well, I mean, I know in India, for instance, they have these massive monsoons, and they used to have, you know, really sophisticated technologies for trapping the water and having it refill the groundwater supply. But in recent decades, a lot of those infrastructures have fallen apart, and so it's not a question of shortage of water. It's just a question of poor management.
It is a question of lack of water, depending where you go. There's different regions
right.
there,
and
some
agree.
Of the some of the areas definitely have, due to a lot of man-made influences, have changed the weather pattern for the worse quite a bit, and some of that, you know, needs to be reversed, because they're struggling with very, very low rainfall. Even though, you know, the majority of India is not, there are large areas that do.
Right. No, I mean, in Africa and Central Asia and wherever else we're looking. But we also understand, you know, that a lot of agricultural systems do not manage their water intelligently. That if you can use things like drip irrigation, you know, you use a minuscule amount of the water that you would otherwise use in a flooding situation, but you can also fertigate and feed the soil and the plants directly through that same drip system. The potentials of this are quite profound, and of course we can't, you know, go to the middle of the Sahara and expect things to turn
right.
around immediately, but there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, as it were.
Yes. I got one more that was submitted on the blog, and this
mm-hmm.
is the last one on the blog. It says, okay. Hi, Dan and John. This comes from Nataraj.
Okay.
As I see more and more farmers become interested in remineralization, I observe them just adding rock dust to the soil without regard for whether what they're adding is what is actually needed. My experience
right.
in working with John has shown that too much or the wrong ratios of mineral may not be what we need to produce nutrient-dense foods.
Right.
And then the second paragraph, I would like to hear Dan's perspective on this issue. Also, the remineralize.org website has great exposure to the world. Do you see a value in educating people not to simply dump rock dust into the soil and think this will solve the problem of nutrient-deficient crops? Thanks, Nataraj.
Well, very insightful and very pointed. Yes, Nataraj. I think this is one of the people who's on the Brix Talk listserv.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is part of why I have focused on the Real Food Campaign from my earlier work with Remineralize the Earth. I understand that the basic, you know, the biological process that the Earth goes through, you know, is done in geological time spans. So we're talking about glaciations every, you know, however often, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. And we understand also the role of biology in shifting minerals from one form to another. This is something that I am sensitive about bringing up, but biological transmutation, which is a well-documented, you know, scientifically process, which is that biology, you know, microbes do shift minerals from one form to another. So if you, I'm not sure what the math is, but I think it's, you know, it's oxygen plus magnesium equals calcium. If you basically, if you take the most chemistry looks at electrons and moving electrons back and forth to make compounds. But there's a really good book called Biological Transmutations by a guy named Louis Kevrin, who was the he was a member of the French Academy of Sciences. You know, well, very very hard scientist. And he wrote a book documenting all these different places where this science was clearly, you know, shown that biology does have the capacity to shift minerals from one form to another. And if you look at a lot of the rock dust that's available, it's, you know, high in silica, and silica is one of those things that easily turns into calcium. And through the work of Reams, we understand the critical role of calcium. So I don't think that the two are contradictory, but I mean, like anything, if you do not understand your soil science and soil science in general, chemistry and physics, you can put exactly the wrong thing, the wrong kind of rock dust on your soil to put it even further out of balance. It's a very you know, serious possibility. So while I appreciate the ideas of remineralize the earth in general, I think that the more specific scientific application of them through this work is very appropriate. So, I'm not sure if I've answered the question entirely, but
okay. It's a delicate question.
Yeah,
it's an important question.
I'm a big fan of mineral balancing and the biological system, and looking at the soil from the biological perspective and working on that directly. I think it's the most efficient way to do it. If you're talking about forests and major grasslands and, you know, the Siberian, you know, taiga or whatever, then you can talk about broad spectrum rock dust. But if you're a farmer, you know, working on row crops, I think there's no more intelligent thing to do than to really closely manage and balance your minerals and amend with biology, et cetera, et cetera.
I do want to point out a couple things on this question here.
Yeah.
We are going to be covering in the class soil remineralization Reams style.
Right.
And I want to highlight the various different aspects of soil remineralization.
Yeah.
And that's a big word, soil remineralization.
Right.
And
quite vague.
And it is very vague. And
yeah.
And I think one of the most important books that I've ever read is Bread from Stones. And I still think that's one of the most important books I have in my library.
Yeah.
Even though it's quite old, but it sets the foundational questions out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to just jump into this question here. My observation is broad spectrum rock powders are, you could put very large quantities on and basically do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not do all the good that could be done if you followed the Reams type philosophy, but you won't do the harm,
right,
in what I've observed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is, in my mind, it's not a bad thing. You can go ahead and get, you know, very fine gravel dust washout or something, and put on, you know, if you want to put on 10 tons, go ahead. It's not going to hurt anything.
Right. No, but there are some questions of, you know, tailings and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Now, if you get something that's high potassium, that could be a problem.
Right.
But where I find a much more worse problem,
mm-hmm,
is people that go on and they take that idea, that concept, and they apply it to compost and manure. And
right,
they just say, well, you know, put a bunch on. It's sustainable.
Better.
It's sustainable.
Right.
It's a local resource, and I have plenty. Let's put it on. That will do a lot of harm. And so, you know, I don't get bent out of shape if somebody does put this on at high rates, but I will say you need to incorporate Reams concepts, and that means address those phosphates and first of all, address the calcium.
Right.
And we'll cover this in a lot more in depth in this class, soil remineralization.
Right. No, I think, I mean, if you get your calcium and phosphorus basically what they should be, then I think, you know, a broad-spectrum rock dust product is a very important piece of the protocol. There's no doubt.
I agree.
But if you're looking at, you know, you're really looking at the biological system and maximizing biological vitality, there's a real role for hard science and chemistry and physics and you know, all of these kinds of things to really monitor and to utilize as tools in the process. So it's just a question of, you know, going flying blind versus having a map where you're going.
Well, Dan, I want to wrap this up now. I want to thank you for all your insights and sharing, and I'm sure a lot of people have learned some things. And so just really appreciate your time, and this will be available as a free download and also for people to have a playback. So thank you very much, Dan.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And do you have any closing comments or anything you'd like to bring up at this point?
Boy, I think I've covered most of the things I wanted to cover. I'm really looking forward to going to this workshop. I think that there needs to be much more of it out there, and that's part of what we're trying to do with the Real Food Campaign is really, you know, have these materials publicly available and try to serve as a coordinating hub for, you know, this process. So we very much welcome any, you know, memberships, you know, sign up, get the newsletters. If you know anybody that's got money, it would be great to kickstart this process a little bit more. come through the website, and it's a work in progress. It should be, you know, every couple of weeks it'll be a couple more pages up and more sophisticated. So like this whole process, we're just evolving, and best of luck to all the farmers that are at it. I can say as a farmer, it's a whole new world. It's a whole new world, and it's extremely.
So I just had an idea while we were talking. Perhaps if there's a lot of interest out on the East Coast, we could have somewhat of a similar type of a conference that you could host, and then we could do this, and maybe we can get a number of people who wouldn't come all the way to Indiana for this. Is that a possibility?
I know that a lot of the people that I know around here are not planning on going because of the distance. You're really trying to put it into these are the basic pieces of the puzzle, and this is how to get from the beginning to the end. But I think you guys are trying to put it, you know, lay it out in more just overt, these are the facts, this is how to do it kind of thing. Maybe not.
Well,
I don't know. That's just the impression I get.
Let's explore that idea, and I have some other ideas. I'll continue to talk with you on that. And I am looking forward to seeing you in the class, and it's coming up just in a few weeks. So, again, thank you, and I think we'll just close the call now.
All right. Great, John. Thank you very much.
Take care, Dan.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.